The lights are on red. We're away.
Welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, September 5th, 2008. This is episode number 144, and I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to bring you the best in MotoGP commentary and chitter chatter, basically. So, wasn't here last week, back again this week. Thank you very much, Jules and Jim, for taking care of last week's show. I thought it was a good one. I liked the whole discussion about tires. It was great, great stuff, and I appreciate that a lot. We've got a lot of good stuff going on this show. Before we get to that, I do want to mention real quick that if you haven't noticed, by the time you listen to it, I'm hoping it'll be fixed, but you never know. I'm having some issues on the MotoGPOD.com website. So any links or anything that I mention in this show, you can find those links in the show notes of the MP3 file itself. So if you listen to the show in iTunes or whatever, you go to info and all of that, those links will be in there, stuff like that. So we're going to get that fixed real shortly. That about covers that on the website. Let's see, had a whole bunch of email this past week. Like I say, I always do try to answer all the emails, but some of it's been falling through the cracks a little bit. I've been, you know, a bit busy finishing up the summer here, Labor Day weekend, all that good stuff. Had a track day last week, Labor Day weekend, like I said, busy at work, long days, all that kind of good stuff. Falling behind on the email. Something's got to give, right? So if I haven't replied to your email, don't think that, you know, I do appreciate them. I really, really do. It's just that there's only so many hours in the day. And other than that, let's see what else we got on tap this week. Right now, we've got a call that Jim Race did with Eugene Laverty, 250cc racer and also racing in Superbike Series. And it's a really, really great interview. Good stuff. Thanks very much to Jim for taking care of that. I thought it came out great. One thing I do want to mention here real quick, Jim had a few technical difficulties going on with a Skype, which it just always happens when you least expect it, when you least want it. So Eugene Laverty's side is a little bit muddy. You're going to have to kind of concentrate to listen to what he's saying, but what he is saying is really, really good stuff. It's well worth paying attention to. After that, Jules and I do a call, and we talk about Misano, wrap things up, just kind of going on down our usual sort of chitter-chatter about Misano or about the championship and MotoGP in general. It was a fantastic race. If you haven't seen it, it was, actually, let me backpedal a little bit. It was an interesting race. However, there was a 250cc race that was absolutely fantastic. And if you haven't seen that one, that's the one you really got to see. But Jules and I are going to tell you all about that here in a minute or two. So let's see. Without any further ado, why don't we go ahead and get on with it and listen to Jim Race talking to Eugene Laverty.
So this is Jim Race for MotoGPOD, and luckily I've got Eugene Laverty on the phone. Eugene, how are you today?
Not so bad. It's pretty early back here. It's 7:40, I think, so early start for me.
And it's practically midnight here in California. You've got yourself quite a busy month switching back and forth between the two-strokes and four-strokes. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Misano first, and find out maybe a little bit more. I know that you were gridded up 17th, and at one point you're running, I believe, as high as 11th, battling with Paycheck and Abraham. You're kind of a Czech sandwich there, right?
Yeah. And I had a good start to the race, and I found myself in the battle with Paycheck, Abraham, and also Willer up in the factory Honda. And I was up to 11th at one point, and in the battle for what would have been 8th position in the end, but unfortunately, I lost the rear midway through the race, and that was the end of it. And it's really not what I needed at the start of a six-week stint now, six races in a row. And I have a fairly big off, but I'm not so bad. Nothing's broken. So I look forward to this weekend at Donington.
Yeah, that would have been, I believe, one of your best finishes this season, too, and we were looking forward to it. You were getting some great coverage as usual with the MotoGP.com, Nick Harris, and British Eurosport, and they were following you all the way, and they were pretty bummed out that you went out. But that was quite the crash-filled race anyway. Barbera was doing a little bit of havoc up front. I imagine that you saw some of that as you were going through.
Yeah, he was taking out guys. He took out Bassini in a very dangerous place, and there was a lot of other riders going down. I think it was due to the fact that Madrid being so high, it was pushing 50 degrees, so there was a lot of riders going down, and I couldn't really explain my crash. I think it was a lot just to do with the high temperature of the track, but it's not nice when you go down when you're riding comfortably. Like, I can't explain it, but I just have to move on and forget about it.
Well, word is, Pip told me you might be getting some new parts for Indy, but let's first talk about Donington, because now you have to make a bit of an about face and head back to the four-stroke world. You've got yourself a bit of a golden ticket riding with the Yamaha World Supersport team, two races at Donington this coming weekend, and then Vallelunga at the end of the month. How did that come about?
When I went to Brands Hatch World Superbikes just to discuss ahead of next year with a few teams for World Supersport, I spoke with Rocco Zillenberg of Yamaha World Supersport in about the possibilities of next year and what his plans may be. And then on Tuesday, 2 days after Brands Hatch, he called me to ask if I might be available to contest the next two rounds of the World Supersport. So I asked the team and the sponsors and everybody else involved, and I managed to come to an agreement which allowed me to be released for the two races. So an opportunity to ride a race when I'm back, and World Supersport was too good to turn down.
And that bike is no slouch. That's a race-winning bike. I believe Foray was running in second until his off in QP at Brno, so you got a real strong chance here.
Yeah, definitely. It's the fastest bike out there, no doubt. And I only weigh 61 kilos, so it should be fast in a straight line, and the Yamaha chassis has always been fairly good, so I'm looking forward to getting on it. I'm going to be riding it today at Croft for a few 45-minute sessions. It'll be nice to just get my leg over it and get back into the four-stroke way, because the most difficult period is going to be the first 10 minutes readjusting. I know what it was like going from four-stroke to two-stroke, and it was a nightmare the first 10 minutes with 125 riders and 250 riders riding inside me and outside me as I was trying to learn to it. So it'll be nice just to have that extra time to adjust myself, but I think it will be easier, this transition going from two-stroke to four-stroke, because everything's being slowed down rather than being sped up in the other direction.
Do you find that engine braking on the four-stroke, stepping back from the two-strokes, actually helps you out a bit going into corners?
Well, it helps you out a bit for the braking, but then again, there's the engine backing in, which you don't have it on a 250, so it's going to be different to get used to the change in braking, especially with the treaded tires and how much braking force you can use in with the front brake, but also the back, because of the engine braking, you have to be careful.
So, and on top of that, you get to go out and race with Johnny Ray, your pal, right?
That's right. The last time I raced with Johnny was 2003, so it's been 5 years now, so it'll be nice to be back on track with him.
Bit of a rivalry if you're going to have a good bike. I mean, the Hansbury Honda is no slouch, but that should be fun. Any words going to be going back and forth?
I spoke to Johnny last night. He called me about 10 to 1 just before, just after I got a late flight into England last night, and he just called me, and we were just talking about the curly tires and what to expect, because I've never ridden them before, so there'll be a rivalry for sure once the weekend comes, but he's helping me out at the minute just to help me in any way I can to adjust to the Supersport back.
And I believe the manager of that team is Wilco Zeelenberg, who back in the day was quite a two-stroke and four-stroke rider himself, so maybe you can grab some information from him, possibly.
Yeah, he's coming up to the test today, so no doubt he'll lend a hand, and he was a very handy 250 rider, so I think he knows how difficult it is to hop from one to the other, as he did it himself, but at the same time, I think he knows how tough the 250 class is if you don't have the machinery, and that's why he gave Anthony West the opportunity this year, and then again myself, when I've only scored 8 points in the 250cc World Championship. It's a great opportunity to give any rider after two seasons of not really performing, but on the power bikes, of course.
Yeah, it's been pretty tough with Team LCR, and then again with Bluesons. You know, you went from your real strong run in British Supersport, where you were pretty much on the way to, if not necessarily a championship, right up there until you had your crash at Knockhill. And I think you finished third that season?
Yeah, I ended up third in the championship after I missed some races with an injury, and I had a lot of races where I didn't finish, and it really just cost me for the championship. So that is the step from winning races. I won four races that year, and then to the next year, just scoring just 7 points from battling to finish in the top 15. It was difficult, but I was prepared for it last year. I knew the bike wasn't going to be up to scratch, and I knew where I was aiming for. And we did a pretty good job for the first half of the season, but the communication just wasn't there between me and the mechanics, and that made it impossible for the second half of the season to progress. But this year, the bike, I'd hoped it was going to be a step higher, and the bike has been a step higher, but unfortunately, everybody else has taken a step up with their machinery also, so I will end up in one, sometimes 2.5 seconds faster at circuit than I was last year. I'm still battling around the same positions, and I'm not happy with how things are going this year. This year I wanted to make a step forward in positions, as I was prepared for this last year, but this year I really wanted to be gripping into the top 10 consistently.
Yeah, it's got to be painful when you carry as much or more corner speed than other riders on, in theory, better bikes, but then they walk away from you on the straights. And I guess that they just brought over, or at least in the last couple of races, more riders are ending up with the full factory RSA 250. That's the traction control monster, and that's got to be tough.
Yeah, it's hard because I know them guys are getting better bits on their bikes as they go along because they are developing things like traction control, whereas parts for my bike aren't really forthcoming. I haven't seen anything on my bike since May, June time, and we've been hoping for these electronics and a different swing arm just to put us on. Not so even so much on a level playing field, but give us some more adjustability, but that hasn't been forthcoming. And even with the swing arm, I probably have said it could be 2 to 3 months before we get the swing arm, which would see the end of the season at Valencia. So it doesn't offer me much motivation in that respect, but I'm still at Misano. I was pushing on to do as best I could, but unfortunately that meant two crashes throughout the weekend and a few big knocks along the way.
Well, I think you showed a lot of people that you've certainly got the heart to do it. It's a question of actually having the right machinery behind you. Did you get a chance to talk to Carl Harris? Because I know that he rode the World Supersport bike at Brands, I think.
Yeah, I spoke to Carl at Brands, but I haven't been speaking to him since. He was at Cadwell Park for the BSB, but I didn't make it along there, so I haven't spoken to him since. But I'm sure he'll be along this weekend, speak to him, no doubt.
And so, once you finish up with Donington, you've got a fairly quick turnaround to come to the States to go to Indy. Now, that's quite a different race for obviously everybody. At least nobody's got any track information beyond what you will. It's going to be new for everybody, and the surface is, to some point right now, still in question. But it's the first time since we've had two strokes back in the States since, I believe, 1991.
Okay.
And I, for one, am definitely looking forward to it. Hopefully I'll get to talk to you guys out there. Have you gotten any information about the track, or are you just coming out kind of green?
Yeah, just really what I've read, same as the other guys. So we'll just come out and see what the track looks like on Wednesday and take it careful Friday morning. But everyone's starting on an even playing field. Nobody has any track knowledge. It's similar to how Misano was last year. No rider had rode it in that direction before, so it will make it interesting, certainly, for Friday to see who comes to the fore. But I think some of the older guys who have been around and know all the tracks like the back of their hands will certainly struggle on Friday morning. Like Alex de Bon even struggled at Misano because that was the first year he'd been there. He's been racing Grand Prix for almost 8 to 10 years, I think, and he went to Misano as this was the first year he'd been there, and he struggled all weekend. I was just 0.1 of a second behind him in first qualifying, so it'll be interesting to see how the old dogs fare at the beginning.
You should have gone over and poked at Nicky. Apparently he did about 30 or 40 laps over there. He's probably got a little bit of inside info. Looked like it was in kind of a World Superbike spec bike too. Had sensors all over the back. I'm sure Michelin was trying to get some additional information.
You certainly needed it.
Got a couple other questions for you. you know, I did a little research trying to get to know you a little bit more, trying at least not sound like a silly, dumb American, and came across this nickname of Norge, and I got no idea where that's from. Can you fill me in?
I got off that yesterday as well. It's from when I was a young lad, and I couldn't say the name George. So my two older brothers nicknamed me Norge, and it stuck from that there.
In the various web searches and whatnot that I did, came across a couple of videos on YouTube that I had to pass on to a couple of people because they were great, including your highly instructional video on how to adjust to new leathers. That one was brilliant.
That's right. That was at the start of the year. Me and Johnny Rowett and Scott Redding were with me and Scott's team to do some preseason training just in January. And in the evenings, it got quite boring, so we found ourselves just entertaining ourselves, and that was the result of it all.
The tandem race at Cadwell Park, I was kind of waiting to see if you guys were going to stall going up the mountain, but I didn't see any air under the tires.
No, we were impressed with ourselves. We managed to get all the way up the mountain when all the riders stopped, but it absolutely killed the two of us. Me and Christian were hanging at the end of it.
Yeah, that one definitely had me cracking up. So, what is you're looking at the end of 2008, and I look at what your career is doing right now, I can't help but make a little bit of a comparison, not totally, because it's a bit different to what Anthony West did last year. You know, of course, his position right now is not one that anybody would envy, but it's a little bit sort of the same thing.
Yeah, it is. He's had the same opportunity last year, and he made the most of it. So really, I have to go to the Donington and Vallelonga and try and do a Westie and try and surprise a few people. But I'm confident I can run towards the front. It would be nice to pop a surprise and do something special, which will be difficult because the other guys are up to speed, and the pace they're setting this year is so much more hot than last year. There's a lot of strong riders in there with Johnny in there now. And of course, Andrew Pitt, who's a former Moto Grand Prix rider, so it will be nice as well to see how fair and where my level of riding is at compared with those guys.
Do you know Brock Parks at all? Have you met him, talked to him before?
The first time I met him was at Brands Hatch, just on the Sunday. That was the first time I'd come across him, but I'm sure I'll be speaking to him tomorrow and get to know him a bit better.
So hopefully maybe he'll pass you some information, or you think he's going to look at you like a true competitor and kind of keep quiet?
Well, I suppose it depends how fast I am on Friday morning, how much information he gives out.
That's a good point. So, with Indy coming up, it'll be great to have you guys come out here. I hear it's your first time to the States, right?
That's right. I've never been to America before, and somewhere I've always wanted to go to, so it'll be nice to go there and
go ahead.
I've been asked to go there and to come there with speak English. I enjoyed it being in Australia last year at the other side of the world and having people speak English, so it will be nice in America as well.
Coming back to the BSB series and whatnot, I was in email, I was talking to Pippa, and we really don't get an opportunity over here in the States. It's not on television. It's the only way you can get it is through the net and through various and sundry means that aren't quite, you know, up to legal code, I suppose. But I've been watching it pretty carefully, and as well as your brothers. I was just kind of wondering if you had a favorite circuit. The circuits over there are obviously quite a bit different than the general MotoGP circuits, though they remind me a bit of some of our American circuits.
Of the British tracks that are on the Wood Circuit, I like Golden Park's really nice. It's a rider circuit, and it really flows. Even the new chicane in a couple of years ago, even it flows with the circuit. So it is really nice. Of course, it's dangerous in a few places, but most of the tracks are. A lot of the British tracks do compare with the AMA circuits, and they're not quite as safe and flat as the Grand Prix tracks. A lot of them like to up and down.
Well, if you're thinking of coming over here next year, you might want to talk to Neil Hodgson first, because things are a bit of a mess in AMA for next year.
That's right. I've heard that now, the road changes and everything.
Yeah, watching it's a little bit sad on my side. I don't think I've got a whole lot else. Is there anything you'd like to say to us or any of your friends out there?
Well, I've got relatives in America as well, and some people I know, so well, it would be nice to have a good result in America, just to, in case I'll be watching on TV.
Excellent. Well, Eugene, thank you so much for taking your time today, and wish you best of luck in testing today and at Donington this weekend. You feel comfortable at Donington?
I like Donington. I was fast at the Grand Prix last year and this year. I wasn't a fan of the circuit up until a couple of years ago, but I really got the grips with it in 2006 in Supersport, so it's a very good circuit to be coming through on a bet that I don't know.
Yeah, I was looking at the results on the 250, and I'm like, oh, that's got to hurt, because obviously being at your home track in the GPs, you want to do well, and your results probably weren't up to what your expectations were. So I'm looking forward to seeing a good result for the World Supersport race, and I wish you best of luck.
Thanks very much, Jim. Hopefully it goes well.
All right, cheers. We'll see you at Indy.
Cheers.
All right, we got Jules on the phone. How you doing today, Jules?
I'm doing good. Welcome back.
Thank you. I had an excellent track day. Thanks very much for taking care of the show last week. It's a good show. Hey, there was a race last weekend, too. So
there was.
Yes, there was a couple of races.
Yes. So,
but let's talk a little bit about MotoGP first. Bit of a shocker.
Yeah, actually, before we even start, I wanted to mention this email that Michael Moynihan wrote to us. He pointed out that a lot of times we speak about a lot of these personalities, especially not the writers, but like people in the paddock and stuff like that. We don't mention who they are. And it starts, and I was watching, the Eurosport feed from the races, and there's a lot of insider commentary between Toby Moody and Julian Ryder, especially who have been commentating on this sport for 15, 20 years or something crazy.
Right.
And we should probably try to like be wary of new listeners who may be new to the sport. And so I wanted to say thanks to Michael for pointing that out, and we're going to try to kind of like give a little subnote when we mention certain people, like Livio Supo, the manager of the Ducati factory team, and stuff like that.
I agree. I thought Michael's email was good, and we do. I know I do. You tend to sort of lapse into this thing that everybody has listened to the podcast for all time, and everybody is a huge MotoGP fan, and maybe we should try to preface some of our stuff. I think the Eurosport commentary is a bit like that.
It is. That's why it's very fanboy based.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the commentary for the serious fan. Whereas like in England, you have luxury of choosing Eurosport or BBC. I think, a newcomer to the sport would go to BBC more. So, yeah.
Right.
So, all right. So we will try to be fair and balanced, because that's the way to,
Without, of course, getting like insane, like, the Vizioso won like a 125cc championship in 1998 and 2003.
Right. Exactly. We can't do so much of that. So,
we had a race, and we had huge expectations for this race, because it's Misano. It's one of the tracks. So for Rossi, it was like a fairy tale kind of thing, where we've got a track that's like 6 miles from his house. It's the only track that he has raced on, but he hasn't actually won on. And he's about to, if he wins this race, he takes 68 wins in the premier class, which will tie Agostini's record. It couldn't be. Am I missing one? Anything else as far as Rossi?
As far as Rossi, no, I can't think of. I mean, yeah, his hometown is just down the street, and I knew that this would be, Rossi wanted to win this one. But I also think that the Ducati, the team, that this is somewhat their second home race.
Yeah, this is very close to Bologna, and then you've got Caparossi with his 277th start. I think it's the most ever starts in GPs.
Yes. Oh, what? Yeah, Nick Harris said some comment about, you know, that how long he'd been racing it, and oh God, what was it? I mean, it was just, you know, it's just insane, you know, that he's racing when, you know, Casey Stoner was in, you know, grade school and things like that. I mean, it's just been such a long time.
Yeah, I think he was racing when Casey Stoner was two.
Yeah.
Because he'd been racing for 19 years in ZPs, and before that he was racing in some Italian race series.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Incredible, and, incredible.
Looks like the old fossil's going to be back next year, too, so that's good. Yeah. So, we got a lot to talk about. Fossil. There's all kinds of silly stuff.
On, let's call him the professor. that's what they said on his helmet, Professor Caparossi.
Yes, yes, the professor. Il professore.
Got the doctor, the professor. And anyway, this, so of course, but the big spoiler for the weekend was that Casey Stoner was just on.
During the free practice and the qualifying session? Oh, yeah.
Just as usual, from the very beginning through qualifying, he was just blowing the field.
Right. Away. Threw down the gloves. And, yeah, this is how it's going to be, folks. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I actually picked on this one, I picked Rossi to win and Stoner to finish second, just because I think that even with Rossi's smart enough to know that the championship is the overall super important thing. But I can't help but believe, and I'm, you know, I'm sort of using my Wayback Machine here, putting myself before the race, that that Rossi, for this particular race, he really wants to win, you know?
Yes.
And I wouldn't quite go out on the limb and say win it or bin it, but it's, you know, there's no holds barred.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, the thing is that there was a possibility that no matter how much he wanted to, that it wasn't going to happen.
Sure.
You know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yes. Especially after the free practice sessions with Stoner and all of that and everything. I mean, it started looking like, wow, you know, maybe Stoner is just on fire. Maybe Rossi will do the sort of championship-wise decision of, like, I'll just take second, you know, that kind of thing.
Although he categorically said he would not be riding for second.
Right.
Even what he says and what he does
are going to be two different things.
Of course, of course. At some point, you know, if you're 20 laps into the race and you're 10 seconds behind Casey Stoner, you're going to say, you know what?
Got 20 points is better than none. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you sort of second guess yourself and everything. But yeah, I mean, if we go down the classification like we've been doing for the last, you know, couple of races, you know, it kind of, Bruno was a bit weird. And if we do it here, it's going to be the same sort of thing, but we can do that where we just kind of go down the winners.
Let's talk about what happened until the seventh lap, and then we can go down to the winners.
Maybe. That sounds
because,
good.
So we had a start, which was, so again, qualifying went very well for Rossi again.
Yes.
It's been very important for him to get on the front. He got on the front again. He was in second spot after Stoner. And, you know, the start was a good start for everybody. But the real surprise was Danny Pedrosa, who, well, that's not a surprise in terms of starts because he's always been a fantastic starter.
He's a good starter, yeah.
But we've kind of forgotten about him because of all this Michelin woe. And there he was
injuries.
in front of Rossi. And I don't know if you actually caught the second corner. You know, Vermeulen had that incredibly close to high side moment.
Right.
Did you see that?
I did, and Rossi had a moment too.
And then
also,
Rossi had a moment a little bit later on.
Right.
Basically, the combination of Danny getting in front of him, and then Rossi having a really pretty massive moment himself. By the time we were done with the first lap, Stoner had cleared off like I think a second and a half. It was just insane.
Insane. He's just checking out. Yeah.
And in fact, it was. You know what's really crazy is I was looking at the lap times.
Mm-hmm.
And his lap time on the first lap, that means it's including the start,
mm-hmm.
was faster than I think most of Anthony West's lap times during the race.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
That's, yeah, it is amazing. I mean, yeah, he did on his first lap, including the start, a 140.1, which was by far the fastest lap of any rider for the first lap.
Yeah.
And he was 1.7 seconds out ahead of Rossi at the end of the first lap.
Yeah.
And he did. You know, it just started looking like, you know, this is Stoner's strategy, is I'm going to check out. I'm just gone, you know. Rossi, and this is an interesting email, which unfortunately I don't recall exactly who sent it to me, but this is a good point that Rossi may have in some ways, because he's never been a super great starter, right? We know that.
Yes.
He's never in particular been the best of qualifiers. You know, he's up there and all that, but every now and then. Because the thing is perhaps Rossi has gotten a bit like, well, you know, if I don't get the greatest start, I've got 25 odd laps or whatever to work my way up. And I can
do
that. And
it's worked for him in the past, obviously.
Exactly, exactly. And so now he's changing his strategy up. He knows he's got to be on the front row. He knows he's got to get a good start because he can't let Stoner run away.
Yeah, I wonder how much of the electronic, if there was any of the electronics package he got in Brno actually included some launch control, which he hasn't really been using that much. I mean, I don't think he's one of the few riders. I think Nicky Hayden, Rossi, and maybe a couple of other riders don't really rely on launch control. The rest of them have pretty much gone to launch control. But I think he may now be using that because his starts in the last couple of races have been great.
Yes, they have. They have. He's somewhat turned a corner. And that could be a combination of electronics and mental wherewithal or whatever it is. But
Right. I'm not dismissing the fact that he's also just paying extra attention to the start.
Right, and I'm not trying to discount or anything like that, but I wouldn't doubt that he's using launch control as one of his whole cards and all that, but it's almost like I think when you're Rossi and you've been accustomed to this, that you know that you can manage your tires better and that your performance in the last half of the race is going to be so excellent, et cetera, and you can just stalk your prey. It would be easy to get a little sloppy. You know,
right?
Not
right.
I think he's realizing that he's not. You know, this ain't gonna work.
not with Stoner and not with Danny actually.
Not with Danny either. Yeah,
Danny on form is just as much of a threat as Stoner is once they get ahead.
He's a formidable opponent. Yeah, and after that first odd lap, he was clearly holding up Rossi. I think, and he pretty much finalized that he's completely dropped off Valentino's Christmas card list. You know that because he managed to get out ahead of him and he was riding really well and everything, but as was apparent once Rossi got around him, he was holding Rossi up.
Yep. And the lap ended with on the last corner with Randy Depuñé falling, sliding off, and being out of the race. And it's funny because the funny thing is he has not completed a race lap yet at Misano after 2 years. Because last year Depuñé went, took Danny and Hayden out. Hayden managed to get back on the track, but he took out Danny.
Right.
And this year he didn't make it around again. So I don't know about you, but I got my 6 points in tipping, so I was really happy.
See, and we've had the discussion about picking the first guy out and all of that and bad juju and so forth. And mine isn't so much bad juju, but just that I just can't believe he's going to do it again. There's no way that he's going to be the first guy out again. You know?
I always have all riders will finish until like just moments before the race, not before the race, but before like after the qualifying. Then I go through again and I check everything. Because qualifying can change everything, like in terms of who's gonna if Rossi was like starting 10th, I'd have my reservations about putting him first.
Right,
but I always end up putting Randy in there or DeAngelis or somebody.
It's a bit of an easy pick, it's a little sad because he's such an easy target. And you sent me a photo of Randy on the grid with his leathers unzipped, and I keep bringing this up, and then I keep complaining about it. So, I got a different shot. The same moment in time, roughly, Randy on the grid, but a different photo. Of Randy
Schiff. So
nice. Yeah, she has a different angle. So we're sending all of those on to Grace, of course, over there at Formula One Blog, because she's the one who started it. And I asked her for an official ruling of, does this one count? Because it's actually pre-crash. You know, the whole thing started because we always saw RDP taking his leathers off whenever... and unfortunately, they'd already recorded their show and everything, so she's holding back. So maybe we'll hear in their next show whether or not RDP's chest on the grid is as satisfying as RDP's chest post-crash.
Got it.
So, but great. And one more time, we're going to get this clear. I don't like the RDP pictures. It's not me.
Signed and delivered.
I know. Okay, I know. Anyway, it is funny. Anyway, moving on. Let's get serious here.
So then we had DeAngelis. We lost DeAngelis on the second lap, which is really a shame because that's really his home race.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's from San Marino.
Trying too hard.
And then, you know, we Rossi got past Danny, and we started getting this, you know, we had this little battle very similar to Brno, where Rossi would take it a little bit in, and Stoner would then take it a little bit back. However, this wasn't a second. We were talking about 3 seconds. So Stoner was way ahead of Rossi. Like, if you were looking at, even that long back straight, 3 seconds means at that speed that they're going on the back straight means that Rossi was like at the first bend when Stoner was already entering the final bend of
right.
those series of four corners. So this is a significant lead.
And it seemed to me that, and looking at the lap times, I think this is true, that Rossi was making up like tenths at a time, not
yes.
big, you know, 3 and 4 tenths. You know, so I mean, this would have been a very hard slog.
Basically, the only thing that I was thinking might happen is that something about tire management will come into play, and that suddenly the times will change. But you know, we know that with Stoner, that just doesn't happen. If anything, he gets faster and faster and faster throughout the race.
Right.
So the only thing that could happen is for Stoner to crash.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, and which you know never happens because he's not a big crasher this year. I was kind of wondering, you know, the first 6 or 7 laps there is like, you know, can Rossi do this? You know, because I think that Rossi is the master of tire management. He's so crafty that you know he knows how to do this. And you know, yes, Stoner is also is very good. But, you know, I was just kind of wondering, can Rossi make this 3 second gap up? Or is Stoner going to see it on his pit board that, hey, Rossi gained a tenth or two or what have you? So, okay, I'll just push a little extra harder on this lap and I open back up to 3 seconds. And that lap would be the whole race, you know, the way it went.
Right.
But, yeah, then on lap, was it lap 7?
6 or 7, I think, yep.
He completed lap 7. He did not complete lap 8. Yeah, so... Stoner crashed. Second race in a row. And this is a bit...
The end.
Out of sorts.
Yeah.
Well, actually, truly speaking, third race in a row that Stoner's bike has been in the gravel.
That's right.
Right. Second DNF in a row.
He broke his clip-on, his right clip-on, so there was no way he was going anywhere.
Right.
Yeah, he fell in, you know, leading the race and... in an unusual place. And afterwards, he said that they've been trying this kind of trick where they scrub the tire end during warm up, and they let it cool down, and they warm it up again with the tire warmers. And that they've tried it a couple of times, and it worked really well to give him extra grip at the beginning of the race, which is you know the most important part for him because he wants to get away and start setting his rhythm. And it kind of backfired. Apparently, like either they let it heat up too much during warm up, or too little, or for whatever reason, he did not. The right side of the tire was a little bit slippery, and you can even see that. And there was a couple of moments that he had where he almost went out of the saddle. And you know, with Stoner, you get used to that because you see it so often, and he just seems like that doesn't faze him, but. Some of those things were definitely front tire slipping out in the right corner. So basically, whenever he was going to the right turns, he was having a little bit of trouble. And this one time he slipped away. So you know, last time was like a geometry issue with the bike. This time it seems like they messed up the front tire with that little scrubbing procedure that they did.
Right, and whenever they give you these kind of details, I'm always extremely suspicious, to be honest with you.
Oh really?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, if that was totally 100% true, why would you tell this? You know, the geometry
point,
thing.
When he's 75 points off, does it matter?
Well, each race matters. I mean, And I think, you know, so I just don't look sort of a, it's a little bit like when, you know, when Honda has some sort of, you know, mechanical failure, oh, it's electronics, you know,
thing. This seems really detailed though. It's like,
I know that's the thing. Yeah. And it's, I don't know, maybe, you know, I always take it with a grain of salt. Maybe that's the way I should put it.
But fair enough.
I did think it was a little odd. The corner that Stoner crashed in, and the way you look at the crash, and it's kind of like, you know, wow. You know, so it might very well be that that's 100% true. And if that is exactly, you know, the situation, 100% true, are they going to continue this tire scrubbing trick, you know, at Indy or at any of the later races?
That was exactly what I was kind of leading to, is you know, the team has worked out all sorts of little, you know, minor advantages that may be helping him in the start of the race, and it's cost him, mm-hmm. you know, a huge amount of points. Because really, if you think about it, when you are looking to score 25 points and then you lose and you score zero, it's like losing 50 points in a lot of ways, you know?
Pretty much. Yeah, exactly.
To the guy you're fighting against, you know?
Right, right. Just like we said that, you know, with Rossi, you know, 20 points is a lot better than none.
Yep. After Laguna, it wasn't so bad at all. But Bernal, ouch, and Misano, the end.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I mean, again, still, we're still not mathematically out, but no, we're done, you know, realistically. I really think, you know, and I don't want to, you know, do any sort of jinxing or bad juju and all of that sort of thing. But barring some just disaster for Rossi, he's got it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's enough of a lead that we're at that point.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, if Stoner continues to implode, then he gets to keep his number two plate.
Yeah. Exactly. Which I think that's... I would not be surprised if that's a bit of a goal for Danny.
To get number two again?
Yeah, just and they'll run the number two again. I mean, you know, his number, his actual true number of 26 mm-hmm. has, you know, significance for him and this and that. So I was a little surprised this year when he ran the number two, and it was a statement. It was, you know, yeah, I didn't win the championship, but hey, I'm number two. I beat Rossi.
Yeah.
And so now I think it's going to be the same thing to Stoner, and he's got the, you know, hey, I was injured. I had three races right in the heart of the season where, you know, it just, things weren't coming together. You know, so he's got a bit of that. I don't want to say excuse, but you know, excuse. And, you know what I mean? I'm reason, whatever. Yeah. And all of that sort of thing. And that, you know, that, hey, 2009, better watch out. That's what I would think I would not be surprised. And even with Stoner and this, do we want to go on to the other big news story of the week right now?
Let's now go down the actual finishing order and just talk about
it. Let's do that. Okay, so we talked about Stoner's non-finishing. So obviously Valentino Rossi ended up winning the race.
We were all expecting, I think, Jim Race and I last week, we were talking about, you know, just what kind of a celebration Rossi's going to put on with Ago there, and they're going to ride the Yamahas around. And we got nothing. And I think the part of it was that I think Ago is actually not all that keen on having his record matched or beaten. He apparently was not even at the track. He went home, and he was at the track the day before, but not for the MotoGP race. He went home and he was watching it on TV.
Oh wow, I hadn't heard that. Yeah,
and the other thing is that, you know, that track invasion started, and I think at that point it was like, I just better get my bike to Parc Fermé and, you know, celebrate afterwards.
Right, right. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, track invasions in Italy are, you know, fairly commonplace. So yeah, there wasn't much of a, you know, some of the things we've come to expect from Rossi of big sort of choreographed celebrations.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I suppose in some ways that was a bit of a, you know, somewhat disappointing maybe for the fans that were there. But it was still, I think that just the sheer, I think Rossi was happy to win this one again. Seeing him in the podium interview and all, yeah, he was, he's... I don't think he's enough of an ego or anything like that, that he might realize that, that good fortune is some, you know, somebody else's bad fortune is his good fortune. And that, you know, so things are smiling on him and this is good. And I will go ahead and, you know, and I'll take that. And hey, I'm damn glad I won this race because it was looking a little doubtful there.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So, So Rossi won, extending his lead in the world championship to 75 points, which, like I said, I pretty much think drives
the...
Five races left, right. And so, like I said, mathematically, yes, it's not a done deal. But realistically, I think it is a done deal.
Yep.
And second place was Jorge Lorenzo.
Right, which, who had a great start. And
they had a great race.
He had a great race. I mean, when Stoner fell, he was, you know, I think about 3 seconds back from Rossi and actually managed to catch Rossi a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then Rossi was the one that had to kind of manage the distance from Lorenzo because, you know, Lorenzo would love to spoil.
Oh, yeah. I think so.
Rossi's party there. Right.
Did you see, though, that in Parc Fermé, the Rossi kind of came up and there was, you know, sort of hugs and handshakes and goodness and all of that?
There was a very, very nice little... you know, moment between those two with, you know, Lorenzo pointing to Rossi, the guy, you know,
right.
And hugs. And yeah, it was cool.
I think it was cool. And I think they're both being, you know, somewhat, you know, good sports and all of that sort of a thing.
Well, you know, the saying with Rossi is he's going to be a good sport as long as you're not beating him. And Lorenzo didn't beat him and he's not in any danger of beating him in the championship. So they could be friends next year. We'll see.
Different story. Exactly. Yeah. Good point. But yeah. And Lorenzo had started on the front row of the grid. Third spot. You know, I think he did a good race overall. And I think that's significant in that considering his injuries from Laguna Seca,
Catalunya,
his injuries all year long, you know, this kid's broken and,
he banged his head pretty hard in Catalunya. That was actually, I think that was probably the worst part of his injuries was the concussion because he was knocked out. So it was a very
severe concussion. Right. And we've discussed the concussion things on here before that it's a serious injury and he's breaking bones in his feet and just, you know, he's got to ride through this. And even with the summer break and all that, that's not that long of a time, you know? So I admire him. I think he's doing well. I do like Formula One Blog's habit of calling him Maverick. Have you caught that?
Yeah.
I think that's awesome.
they even had a photo on their on the website of Tom Cruise and...
Oh, I missed that.
And Lorenzo at one point.
Yeah, yes. Tom Cruise, famous MotoGP fan. And, all right. Moving down the classification. Jorge Lorenzo in second spot, which, let's see, where's he at in the championship now?
He's still fourth.
Still fourth. He's...
he's extended his lead from Dovizioso, who was catching him quite well, but... But now, with this result, Dovizioso did not have a good race.
Right. And so, yeah, Jorge picked up the 12 points on Dovizioso here. So it puts him on 140 minus. So, yeah, he's way, way, way back from Rossi. He's actually a long ways back from Danny, who's in third spot, 45 points back from Danny. So, yeah, definitely no threat to the championship. And realistically, he might be able to move up to third, but I think we're looking at a top five. But still, for your rookie year... Nothing to sneeze at.
Not at all.
No. Especially when you do consider all of these, the injuries and troubles that he's had. So, good stuff. Next up on the podium, third spot, Tony Elias. Second podium in a row for team, Aliche team.
Yep.
And I think that's great news. Great stuff. Didn't get a chance to send Liam an email. I should have, saying congratulations. But it's good to see those guys up there.
Definitely. Liam actually posted on Right On 2 and on Barf about it. So, he basically just said, you know, well, it shouldn't come as a surprise. They've been working really, really hard, obviously. So this is like, you know, the payoff that of a lot of hard work. I have to say, Elias was even more impressive than in Brno because him and he passed Danny, I think, on like, lap 6 or 7 or something like that, and then he actually managed to to pull a gap on Danny, but then Danny caught up, and they had really close battle for 4 or 5 laps. And, you know, we had this Spanish 1-2-3, I mean 2-3-4 anyway. I'm sure that Danny did not want to be the last of the Spaniards coming in. So he really put up a good fight with Elias. He caught up to him again, and they went hard at it. But then Elias just cranked it up, and he had some really fantastic laps. Maybe 4 or 5 flat laps from the end. He put up some really, really fast laps. I think he was like at that time the fastest guy on the track.
Was he? I'm double checking.
He didn't get the fastest time, but he was. Let's see, like Rossi was pulling 35.8s, and Elias was like 35.4s.
Yeah. Around the lap 22-21 range. Yeah, he was. He was smoking.
Yep.
Yeah.
Great.
Sorry.
He did very, very well.
I think he did, again, a super race. And, you know, this race is like so many of the others that we've seen that, yeah, the win is a bit of a runaway, but there's such good racing farther down. And, I think the battle for second and for third, you know, the 2-3 battle was significant.
Yep. You know, Danny Pedrosa came in fourth, and I don't know. Do you want to talk about everybody, how everybody finished, or just let's just go into?
We're at already 30-odd minutes, so we're going to make it a fairly long show. Let's just cover the top few.
Okay, so we had Pedrosa who finished fourth. Then we had Christopher Mullin, who once again had a good ride.
Yes,
he's definitely making a good. Actually, there's now rumors that he is officially signed with Suzuki, so
it's insane. The rumor mill is insane. I mean, I don't
even know how deep we want to get into that.
Yeah, exactly. I know we should cover it a little bit. Darren kind of gave me a heads up for that on the Formula One blog, and this is something we've heard that, you know, talking that Speeds wants $2 million a year, which is probably what he's making in the AMA. And we've heard this before, that Spies...
This is, I mean, we've been talking about this in the show for like three or four episodes now.
Right, so we're getting totally distracted. But real quick, that you know, Spies doesn't want to take a pay cut to go into MotoGP. And at a certain level, I don't blame him. But on also another level, it's like, dude, you know, $2 million is more than most MotoGP riders make. And you know, why don't you get to MotoGP, prove that you're worth that, and then start talking about it. You know what I'm saying? Or maybe prove that you're worth 20 million.
I had a conversation about this on the Ride On 2 forums with somebody at one point, and they said, you know, the problem is that when you have a solid salary like that, I know it's relative to the kind of money that we make, it seems like a lot of money, but people get themselves in those. I'm not trying to defend the guy.
You need that $2 million. I mean, I mean, this is true at every level. You know, you make 30 grand a year. It's
he's got to make payments on that Gulfstream 5.
Right. Or whatever it is. Exactly. And, you know, so, and I can understand you don't want to go and work for
time.
What's that?
I wonder how you repossess an airplane.
Oh, probably the same way.
Do they fly it off?
I don't know. Maybe they just go lock it.
Anyway, sorry.
but you know, yeah, you don't want to go somewhere and work for half of what you made last year, or what have you.
Actually is something that the rumor about Christopher Mullin was that he was kind of forced to take a bit of a pay cut.
Was he?
Yeah.
Actually, I wouldn't be too surprised thinking about it. But in any event, yes, the rumor mill, the solid rumor mill, has it that the musical chairs from Suzuki has ended.
Yes.
And Ben Spies is still walking around.
Yep.
So, you know, we're looking. And now the other rumor mill is that LCR has signed him. Or is it Team
LCR,
Scott?
LCR has apparently signed everybody. He's also signed Hayden. And, I mean, that guy's a little bit.
Did you see the one that Team Scott? Because you got Team Scott, you have kind of two principals.
So Team Scott is Dovizioso's team. And,
right. But apparently, in the 250 side, who races for Team Scott? It's
Yuki
Takahashi. Yes, Yuki.
Yeah, Yuki Takahashi.
And Yeah, so basically, in effect, you've got the two bosses of JIR Team Scott, or whatever you want to call them, both saying different things. That, yeah, we've signed Yuki Takahashi. We've signed Ben Spies. It's like we guys have one motorcycle. And
there's the rumors that there's going to be two.
Yes, exactly. And that's actually probably pretty realistic.
Yeah, because those guys don't get along.
Mm.
It's pretty clear.
You mean the two principals?
Yeah.
Or Yuki and Spies? Because I don't think Yuki and Spies have ever met.
No, the principles of this. I think it's pretty much a done deal that the team is splitting. It's just a matter of whether there's actually going to be two bikes or whether one of them is going to go back to 250s.
Yeah, right. Or if they'll continue this sort of weird dichotomy. Because, I mean, there's a lot of advantages to having one team with two bikes.
Oh, of course.
And, you know, so maybe these guys can get along and each sort of sign their own guy, you know, a little bit like what we have with Yamaha, where it's almost like two separate teams within one team.
Yeah, and what we have with Camel Honda.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of teams. It's not a new thing. So, yeah, I think that they'll, you know, I mean, their results this year are respectable so that, you know, they can probably find the funding. And I think that if they can say next year that, hey, look, we got, you know, one of the hot guys of 250s and we've got Ben Spies, you know, give us some money and you know, you'll see a new sponsor, et cetera, et cetera.
We had James Tolson kind of returning back to form. He had his sixth, that was his best finish all season. Well, he's had a couple of sixths.
Yeah, I was going to say,
So it's good to see him there. I think the most interesting thing about the finishing was what was this Bridgestone, Michelin, basically until Colin Edwards in 10th place.
Yeah, it does flip-flop, doesn't it? Wow. Yeah.
So Michelin, you know, kind of is back. Although, of course, you would have had, if Stoner had stayed on, we would have had Bridgestone.
Right.
At the top.
But they didn't.
You know, but they didn't. And Michelin, you know, did well because you look at Lorenzo, he kept that gap pretty close to Rossi. If he had a better start and he didn't get mixed up in the beginning, he may have been fighting for the win.
Yeah, sure. I agree. And do you think, though, that this does mean that Michelin is back, that they've worked out whatever the hell problems they had going on for the last month, and now all of a sudden that they figured it out and that they're going to go to Indy, which I'm sure is rated as one of the favorite tracks in the Michelin, you know, Hall of Fame.
Oh, yeah. They have lovely memories.
Which, okay, in the spirit of our new Explain Weird references, that's a Formula One reference because a couple of years ago there was a disaster in Formula One for Michelin at Indianapolis.
To the point where there was only six cars racing.
And none of them were running Michelins.
Right.
But, yeah, let's not go down the Formula One road. So, has Michelin figured their stuff out?
Well, you know, and I Darren, I know, emailed me and said that he didn't really agree with this, but Jim Race raised a very valid point, I think, last week, which is that it's not really necessarily the tires; it's more like the people choosing, making decisions that are really a problem. So it wouldn't be that hard. It wouldn't be like, oh my God, we have to go come up with a completely new compound. It's more like we just have to make the right decisions and bring the right stuff.
Right, bring the right tires.
Had
they listened to Laguna Seca, they would not have had a problem. Had they listened to Nicky
Exactly. Hayden. Nicky Hayden, Colin Edwards, all those guys were telling them exactly what to do.
Right.
They ignored them. And they ignored them at Sachsenring, too, because they forced all the riders to ride on a tire because they were scared of giving them a slightly harder compound.
Right. And, you know, oddly enough, that was the problem in the Formula One race in Indianapolis. They were
worried about that banking.
Right. So is that the Michelin problem? Is not so much that they can't build a good tire. We know they can build a good tire. But it's just that there's a level of uncertainty about letting people use the tire in a certain situation because you're worried about the banking or the weather or the track surface or whatever it is. And so you go too conservative and you bring, you know, the bowling ball tires for the track where you need the softer stuff.
Very well could be. Very well could be somebody just afraid of making a monumental mistake.
There you
and
go.
In turn, making a monumental mistake.
Right. So we've got Indianapolis, which is probably a bit of an unknown, although we've done significant amounts of testing there.
Most of the guys who have tested there are actually on Bridgestones.
Right, exactly. Suzuki, thinking about it.
Ducati,
yeah.
You know.
So, I mean, you know, they could make a mistake there. Japan, they should be in good shape at Motegi. They should be. And they should be.
Well, I mean, you know, Motegi is a Bridgestone track.
Yes, it is.
It always has been a Bridgestone track. It was the first place where that Bridgestone actually... Was it the first place? Was that the first race where Bridgestone won? I think, actually, they won at Rio.
Oh, first. Boy. But, breaking stuff out a couple years ago in different orders of races and all that. I can't remember.
No, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Tamada's win, but that was actually before that, the Ducks won in Catalonia.
Yeah. In any case, though, it is clearly a Bridgestone track.
Yeah.
But they should have the data. You know, they should know. And,
the Ducks were on Michelin's that first year. Sorry about that. So yeah, I think Tamato gave them their first win. That was in Rio. But anyway, they have the data because they've been racing at that track for, you know,
for so long,
two decades or something crazy. Like
yeah,
that.
And actually the last three races you got Phillip Island, Malaysia, my favorite track. Which if we're going to go back to the Bridgestone track, Michelin track sort of thing, Malaysia is another Bridgestone track. Although I think that's somewhat going out the window anyway. Mm-hmm. The whole, you know, this track is a certain tire track. And then Valencia. So, you know, realistically, Michelin should have the data for solidly four out of the five remaining races. They really shouldn't be getting this wrong.
Right. We had a rumor before the race that Pedrosa was going to go to Bridgestones before the end of the season. And during the race, they were talking about it. And after the race, it was confirmed. Even though everybody was kind of laughing it off, I was totally laughing it off. I was like, no way. Next year, for sure, the HRC is going to have Bridgestones. But to do a tire switch in the middle of the season, no way. End of the race comes in. You know, I think it was Randy Mamola that brought the news. It's official. As of Indianapolis, actually, as of the test.
As of Monday, yes. As of after Monday, the race, yes.
Yeah. Danny Pedrosa is going to be racing on Bridgestones. Nicky Hayden is not. And they actually even talked to Nicky about this, and they said, so is there going to be a wall built in the garage? And Nicky goes, what? Don't you think there's already a wall there? Or something to that effect.
I was going
to
say, yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, make the wall higher. And it is a bit of a surprise. And actually, I want to touch on an email that Mark Smith sent. That, and he was pointing this out, the news that Pedrosa switched to Bridgestones. He says, are we, for one, and this addresses some of the things that we said, are we not now looking at MotoGP being a one-make tire series without an official rule, which is kind of what you were sort of advocating, if you will, on a call or two ago?
Yeah.
But also, Mark pointed out, and this is what I kind of really wanted brought. He says, I can't see this as having any benefit for Pedrosa as the next race is less than 2 weeks away, and he's going to be able to get sawed all time to get used to the Bridgestones unless he's been doing some sneaky practice on the Nakano Bridgestone Honda motorcycle. At least Rossi had the sense to move before the start of a season, so he had plenty of testing set up and data gathering time. Would have not have been better timed before the long summer break to give the engineers a chance to work things out. And maybe this is Pedrosa and his puppet master Alberto Puig admitting that he couldn't catch Rossi or Stoner this year, so just writing the year off and starting the work for 2009 a bit early.
Which is an interesting strategy, but also I think that Pedrosa wants to win some races before the end of the year.
I agree.
And I think that when Rossi started the season, the preseason, he was the only guy in Yamaha that was riding a Bridgestone. In fact, remember during some of the testing, they brought in two Japanese riders. Sorry, I forget their names, but they were at a couple of the preseason events. They were riding Yamahas with Bridgestones specifically to help develop that bike. And it took, you know, a good three races before Rossi's pace was that of, you know, the other Bridgestone riders. It's actually more importantly that the bike was actually able to handle it does amaze me how you know, like, how much of a difference it can make, but it really does, because Jerry Burgess talked for a long time about how they had to move the center of gravity to a different place on the bike, and it basically became like a, you know, much more of a Ducati than a Yamaha in terms of weight distribution. So I think that this giving Nakano the chassis and the engine that Pedrosa has been riding on, not the pneumatic one, but the spring valve one, was a precursor to this, just in case that they could pull it off, that they were able to gather data. So I think that Danny has actually quite a bit of a head start.
I agree.
Because those tires on Nakano's bike were not vetted like in practice by somebody who they bring over from Japan just for that purpose, but actually during a race, and right. several races actually.
Right, you're going to gather.
By an
you're going to get some
MotoGP guy.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. You're going to get some very, very valuable data from that. And I think that HRC has a head start already. They know where to sort of start with Pedrosa. And as much as anything, it's probably going to be Pedrosa sort of wrapping his head around the feel, which, you know, this does amaze me. I mean, I know what new tires versus old tires feel like. I haven't had the luxury of trying out a brand new set of Michelins versus a brand new set of Dunlops, you know, just, you know what I'm saying, on the same day or something like that. But it still does amaze me that these guys can tell the difference so much from one brand of tire to the other. That affects their lap times, you know, for them, significant amounts.
Right. It's confidence. It's, you know, the tires that don't have a particularly different profile, as far as I know. So here's an interesting thing that Neil Spaulding was talking about. He's a commentator. He's kind of like a sideline commentator.
Tech guy
on Eurosport. Yeah, tech guy with Toby Moody and Julian Ryder. Doing most of the commentating. Every once in a while, they go to Neil and he talks in his really deep voice, and he has some great things to say. And one of the things that was very interesting that he said was that the Suzuki bikes have been changing their chassis so that they can take to adapt them to the same tire that Rossi and Stoner are using, which kind of clarified an interesting point. On two forums, we were talking about, the best reason to have a spec tire is because then there will be no longer of this this is the Rossi tire and this is the Stoner tire. Everybody's going to have to use the same tires. Well, I don't think that Bridgestone is actually I think they bring the same tires and that everybody have their pick. It's just that the geometry of their bikes might be different. The Kawasaki's might need a different tire simply just because they can't. They don't work very well with the tire that works well for the Ducati or the Fiat Yamaha.
Right, they deliver the power differently.
Yeah, and for example, I think that the Suzuki bike maybe if they put that tire on would eat that tire up like mad. So they have to change the chassis because they want that particular tire. But they're not being prevented from using the tire. They're just that the technology the technical aspects of their machine just don't work with it that well yet. So they're slowly starting to move the chassis, just the way Bridges did with the M1. They're figuring out how to make those same tires work and make them more competitive because that's apparently the best. It's the front tire that I'm talking about.
Yeah. But, yeah, and it is. It's amazing. The whole making the entire bike work as a whole, you know, you've got different engine configurations between these various motorcycles and you know, forks and just all sorts of stuff. So there is a lot of
swing arms, and I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah. It is amazing.
They move the swing arm, you know, joint like a couple millimeters up, and it makes all the difference in the feel of the bike.
Yeah, yeah, it is, and it's shocking to me to imagine this, you know, that these things can make such a difference in the feel. Well, right. Moving on in the results, I do want to touch on Caparossi, our last guy, let's say, coming in seventh, because like we mentioned earlier here in the call, it was his 277th Grand Prix?
Yep. He beat Barros's record. I think Barros had 276 starts.
Right, right. So that, you know, the two old guys, and it's, you know, good for you, Loris. It is kind of neat to see, and you know, he's out there doing well. He is, you know, it's not like he's just sort of, you know, that they're giving them to ride. I don't know, because they feel sorry for him or something. You know, he's truly deserving of this motorcycle.
You know, what I found really funny, by the way, speaking of Loris, is that his wife has she's always wearing something that matches the garage.
Did you notice that? No, I haven't. I'll have to check it out.
It was so funny. In this particular race, they did a shot. She was wearing the Rizla blue color, little summer dress. And then I was like, wait a second. And I went back and looked at a photo of her when he was in Ducati. And sure enough, she was always in red. At least in the photos I could find. So I found that really funny.
Yeah, I'll check it out. Well, in Italian, style is paramount.
Yep, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, it's not quite the same as the Sette girlfriend shots. Those are priceless. So, all right. Anything else?
To wrap up about the whole Danny move, especially the Bridgestones. That was the biggest story of the weekend.
It was the biggest political side shaping up for the series as a whole. Yes, it was the big story of the weekend.
There's a lot of interesting things. Julian Ryder was saying, who is running that team at the moment?
Yeah.
Ryder was actually, Moody was at a loss of words for words when Mamola came back and said, hey guys, it's official.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't know what to say. And then there was an interesting comment from Doohan also, who said that, because, I think a lot of people are like, Danny's a whiner and he's just blah, blah, blah. And Doohan came out and said, but there's nothing wrong with Danny except the people around him.
Oh.
Which is pretty funny.
Which is pretty much clearly.
Because if you watch the interviews with Repsol and all, it's actually Repsol was the one that really was pushing for Danny to get these Bridgestones. I don't know where Puig fits in there, but it was Repsol that took the real they're the ones who stood up in front of the reporters and said, yes, we were the ones who pushed for this because we are very much behind Danny and we want Danny to have the best equipment and we believe that Bridgestone is the best equipment right now. And anyway, that was, I think that was a fascinating story, and it'll be interesting to see how he does for the rest of the season on the new tire.
I agree. It'd be extremely interesting to see how Danny does. Spanish rider, Repsol Spanish company, he and Lorenzo are the talk of the town, and this was brought up in the Dorna broadcast that, that Tony Elias feels a little bit like he's the third wheel, so to speak, as far as being a Spanish rider and all of that. And it's like, it's nice that Tony Elias is getting talked about because he's picked up these two podiums now.
Finished in front of Danny twice.
Right, exactly. And, so it's always,
twice because he finished in front of him in Laguna. Well, actually, he didn't ride at Laguna.
But still, he's still more. And that in Spain, it is always, it's Danny Pedrosa list, Jorge Lorenzo that, et cetera. Tony Elias is always a little bit on the sidelines. And now, Tony Elias is getting some limelight, and that's cool. So, but right. I do, this is a very, very important sport in Spain.
Yes.
And Repsol and Pedrosa's whole team structure are certainly going to take things like this into consideration. If they think that Bridgestones is the way to go, then we're going to get Bridgestones somehow, damn it.
And I'll tell you something else. I think it's also personal that both Puig, I think Puig even more than Pedrosa, feel that they need to beat not Rossi, but Stoner. Because Stoner was the rival in 250s, and I mean, there was also stories about Puig blocking Stoner from getting a factory ride the first year in MotoGP, and before that he was in his way. And there was a time when Stoner was under the tutelage of Puig along with Pedrosa, and Puig had to choose one of them.
Right.
And chose one of them, and then started putting all sorts of roadblocks. I mean, this is all just paddock rumor and type of stuff, but... But started putting all, so Alberto Puig, maybe we should go back to Michael's Moynihan's advice. Alberto Puig is a ex-racer who is he officially the manager of Danny Pedrosa?
I believe he is, like his agent manager.
His agent manager,
right? And he also runs a team still in 250, doesn't he?
Right. No, I don't think he runs the team. I think he runs a school.
Plus, he makes windscreens.
What?
He makes windscreens.
Oh, that's what it is?
Yeah, you can buy a Puig windscreen for most motorcycles, like a zero gravity, only a Puig. Yeah.
That's why I see Puig names on other MotoGP bikes, I guess.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he's kind of rumored to be a very manipulative kind of manager, and always putting feet to trip people up, and you know,
a bit like Rasputin.
There you go. I love it. He's Rasputin of MotoGP.
Yes.
So anyway, so he's. I think it's very personal for them to beat Stoner, and to put him on the same tires will give less variable. Same reason that, you know, Rossi wanted Bridgestones. I don't blame Pedrosa for wanting the Bridgestones. I think it's a little bit reckless. But we'll see. We'll see. He may prove us wrong.
I think Mark's email is actually spot on. There's no way that Pedrosa is going to win the championship this year.
No.
I do stand behind my thing that I think Stoner would, or Pedrosa, that Pedrosa would very much like to get second just yes. because he can rub Stoner's nose in it. Okay, exactly. Rossi's going to win. Pedrosa would love to get second. He's going to carry the number two plate. But that also, though, he's going to have five races on these Bridgestones that will – I mean, these are races. This isn't just test time. He will also get the test time and everything else. You know, he's going to be ready for next year on the HRC Honda, on the Bridgestones, et cetera, et cetera.
You also got to take into account, these guys are like 22 and 21.
Yeah.
Rossi's 29. He's, you know, Rossi's got, you know, maybe 5 years left. Who knows? Maybe he'll be like a Bayless and last, in, you know, almost to his 40s. But I don't think so. I think he's going to retire before that. And then, and so it's much more like, I don't think Rossi is as big of a target to Danny as Stoner, because Stoner has won a championship. Danny has not won the GP championship, and they're the ones who are going to be battling for the next decade.
And they're the same age. They're the next generation coming up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good point. That's an awesome point. So, all right. We need to move on unless we got anything more about MotoGP.
No, plus. Sorry to keep that going. Let's get to the two
races
before we
finish.
Yeah,
it's just I want to talk about it so quick. And this has been brought up in an email or two that we don't talk enough about the 250s. If you didn't watch the Misano 250 race, well, first of all, we're probably going to spoil it here in a second, so you might want to turn things off. And second of all, you got to start watching the 250 races.
They've been amazing all year, and usually yes. we could talk for 2 hours, and I think people are getting a little bit annoyed about the length of the shows sometimes.
I know this is going to be another long one, but that's all right. Yeah. But it was just the whole race was an edge of the seat, and I mean, even I haven't been following the 250s as closely as I should. In a lot of ways, like, you know, it's a little difficult to identify the bike. You know, you see the guy, it's like, well, is that red and white motorcycle? Is that Hector Barbera? Or is that, you know, Simoncelli? You know, you're looking at it and trying to figure out who it is and all of that.
Here's the easy one with Barbera. You know
the spots.
Mario Brothers.
No, Mario Brothers. Yeah,
he's like the mushroom. Like the mushroom
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, with things, the red yeah. spots, yeah, yeah. yeah. And Simoncelli, you know, he got the yellow boots. He's got the Rossi thing going on with the boots. And right. you know, but it's not quite as easy as it is in the MotoGP class for me mm-hmm. to identify the different riders at a glance. But in any case, wow. just like Laguna Seca was, you know, if you've got a buddy, if you've got a friend out there that is not a motorcycle racing fan, and you're going to make him sit down and watch a motorcycle race that you've got stored on your DVR, or your VCR or whatever, that Laguna Seca would be the one for the MotoGP class. Well, you actually got several to choose from in the 250 class, but you know, Misano would be a good choice.
This one's up there.
Yes.
For several reasons. One, because there was some great clean racing, and yes. the other was because there was a lot of
Not so clean
racing,
yeah.
which is great to see. You know, the passion of the Spanish and the mm-hmm. Italian riders just come through.
Right.
I mean, they're got helmets on, and they're in their positions to be as, you know, aerodynamic as possible, and yet you can totally tell the tension. You know.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. And I mean, to put it in a nutshell, in the World Championship, Marco Simoncelli from Italy, who has the giant, you know, Bozo hair, if you've watched the 250s a little
Bozo
bit.
Bozo hair. I love
Bozo
it.
Bozo hair. He's got a good lead going on in the championship, and he had a good lead going on in the championship. And in this particular race, his two main challengers for the
Mika Kallio and Pacini.
Right. Batista was not actually really. He's in third, but Mika Kallio is yeah. in second, mm-hmm. Which was a relatively close second, and then now the gap is opening, and even Batista, you know, basically Simoncelli's got this race. It's like, you know, I can settle down, I can get my 20 points, or what have you. You know what I'm saying? But he was not going to let it go. And he's not going to let, in this case, it was Hector Barbera.
We have to take this back all the way to Mugello.
Probably.
The Barbera and Simoncelli had the little coming together where Simoncelli got Marco was getting really annoyed because Simoncelli certainly had the faster bike down the straight. And no matter what Simoncelli did on the slower sections, when they got to that straight, Barbera was always passing him. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, one of those times that Barbera was passing him, he switched he went across the track, and it just so happened that Barbera was there, and he touched him, and he happened to hit his front brake lever, which caused
a terrific crash.
horrific crash. He was very lucky to not get hurt. He actually didn't get hurt at all. He just got really pissed.
Yes.
And so I think the rivalry between those two guys is probably much older than that, but mm-hmm. it became very, very visible from that point on.
Exactly. And Hector Barbera is not – I don't think he has any friends. He eats alone a lot.
you know, nobody sits with him in the cafeteria?
Yes, pretty much. But he and Lorenzo were famously hated each other. And yes. I think it's the same way with quite a few others, that they just don't have a lot of, you know, Hector Barbera is doing his own thing. And,
you even go to the announcers, both on the Eurosport and Dorna, they were all just like, oh my God, you know, look at the way Barbera is riding. It's going to be another one of those races. Because basically Barbera was riding, you know,
aggressively
is to put it mildly, I think. I mean, he was really riding a little out of control. Like, you know, it's great to see that kind of passion. And it's very important, I think, that riders, and this was actually very well demonstrated what happened between Kallio and Aoyama.
Mm-hmm.
Hiroshi Aoyama and Miki Kallio are both on the same team, KTM. And Aoyama was in front, and Kallio was in back, and Kallio ended up running into the back of Aoyama because there was one corner in which Aoyama was just basically slower. They looked at the telemetry, and he was always slower in that corner. But it took Kallio by surprise, so he hit the back of the bike. He kind of went off. He didn't really fall yet,
Kallio would have been fine, and then
Aoyama's bike fell and
took him out
across his path. Took him out. So basically. But the point is that these guys trust each other so much that they can stay that close to each other. Well, with Barbera, and when you add Barbera to the mix, everybody starts to get a little bit nervous because he's been known to, you know, cut your nose off, run you off the track a little bit, run you onto the rumble strip, use, you know. I mean, I've never actually seen him. I think it's a little bit unfair to say that he's a dangerous, like outright dangerous rider, but he's questionable.
Right. You might want to say he's a dirty racer, but he's certainly a, I don't know, a bit messy, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, something less than dirty. You know, not. You know, and I'm trying to think of the word where it's not like he's outright
evil.
Evil. Yes, but he's a bit. You know, he's not a psychopath, but he's a bit of a just flat out doesn't care, right. You know, kind of a thing. Yeah, and it's a bit different to watch Barbera racing. He's very no holds barred. Well, some holds barred. How about that? And I mean, honestly, you know, because like I said, he's not a. I don't think he's truly a dirty racer or anything like that. He'd be getting,
he's a lunatic. Actually,
yeah, he's a bit of a lunatic. Yeah.
He's a bit of a lunatic, and
but Simoncelli's not willing to let this go. You know
no,
what I'm saying?
No.
And on this race here, you know, Simoncelli's wise choice would have been to just, you know, dude, back
let
off.
It go. Yep.
Let it be. But no, you know, he's out there. And I mean, you know, they're hitting, you know, bashing fairings. Like, you know, this ain't NASCAR, folks. At, you know, at, I don't know what kind of speeds on the 250s, but, you know, there's a lot of contact in that race. There was a lot of just, you know, late apexing and slashing across. And oh, it was a good race.
Barbera ran him off the track twice. And I think that's after the second time, Simoncelli was like, okay.
And then
there was a crash with Piscini, which I have to say that. I'm not sure if I would really blame Barbera for it because a lot of riders passed exactly the same place, the same way.
Yeah.
Both in the 250s, the 125s, it happened. And
Pacini left the door open and Barbara jumped in.
He did go in, but then Pacini tried to close the door. It was too late. And, you know, he actually also did the same thing that happened in Mugello, which is he touched the front brake, and that's what caused it to crash.
Right. Yeah, I thought Pacini was being a little... Already, sorry?
Go ahead.
I thought Pacini was being a little emotional with a lot of that. It's not like Barbera did it completely intentionally. You know,
we also don't know exactly what was happening during that lap.
Oh, sure.
We just see the crash all of a sudden because it was concentrating more on what was happening with Simoncelli and Mika Kallio and Aoyama before that. So anyway, but yeah, so he took out Pacini, let's just say. Pacini took himself out on top of Barbera. So that made the Italians really happy.
Yes.
And then he ran Marco off twice. And I think at that point, Marco was just like, oh, God damn it. You know? Because that final time where they came together, that was not a racing incident.
No. The one where Simoncelli forced Barbera off the track.
Oh, my God. We only have one angle. Yeah. We only have one TV angle of that. But I swear I can see him putting his foot back on the peg.
Yeah, I can believe it.
I really think he stuck his knee way out there and pushed Barbera off.
Yeah, he did. I agree. I think it was. It was a little bit like, okay, that's how we're going to do it. You know, here you go. Yeah. And
so that's racing, Barbera? Okay. We'll see.
Okay, we'll see. Yeah. But on the other hand, it wasn't at a NASCAR level where it's clearly like, all right, Bubba, I'm going to take you out. You know what I mean?
But those guys are in huge cages. They're fat. They're sitting in this gigantic cage. You know, they're totally. I mean, I know that people have gotten hurt and killed in NASCAR, and
it's dangerous still. But yes,
it's a dangerous sport. But it's not the same as actually touching body parts, you know?
It's different, but you know, but I still think though that the 250 race was on a less demolition derby ish level and more of a just like, you know, I don't know, it's just a ballsy level, I guess would be the way to put it. I don't know, it's just a great race.
I would even say the same thing about Bautista. I mean, like
he had his moments.
He had his moments, and he was. I think he had a huge smile whenever those guys made themselves screw up.
Yes.
You know, he was just like, okay, fine, I'll just go through. And then you know, he was in fifth, and all of a sudden he's leading the race.
Right. And just the whole swapping back and forth and everything else. So I mean, if you haven't watched it, you got to find some way to watch it. The 250cc race. It'll be at MotoGP.com. I don't know. Does Speed doesn't even bother rerunning any of the races anymore. I don't think. But
really.
Yeah, I don't think so. They show the 250s. They used to always show them again, but I don't think they do anymore.
Like a month later?
Well, they had like the Motorcycle Tuesday thing, but I think they've given that up. Now they have like show about tow trucks and stuff, which is much more important. It's sad. It sucks. You know, I came home Sunday. I was I was doing something or other, and I was just figuring I'll watch the race on Speed. And normally the race is on at like 1 or 2 in the afternoon for me here on the Pacific time. You know, so I come back and I look at my DVR. Hey, no race. What's going on? Yeah, they didn't even show it till I believe it was 8 o'clock for the MotoGP race, 7 o'clock for 250s, and 8 o'clock for MotoGP class. Pacific time. So that's 10 and 11 p.m. Eastern time. And it's like, you know, what have you guys been showing all day? You know, a bunch of crap. And it's like, come on. So, I mean, maybe it was because it was Labor Day weekend or something. I don't know. But it's just, you know.
Well, I noticed, for example, that that your Skype like little bubble says pissed about Speed Channel.
Does it still? So,
do you have an issue with Speed Channel?
I've had an issue with Speed Channel for years, and that's probably when I set my Skype bubble. God knows how long ago.
It also says surprise.
Yes. Shocker.
Funny. But what a shocker.
No, I still. What's the word I'm looking for? You know, I'm still sad about the whole Speed Channel, what it used to be, what Speed Vision used to be compared to what Speed Channel is today.
And the you know, they have an amazing journalist pool, put a pool of journalists.
Amazing. Dave like their Swain, website's Bob incredible. Yeah,
I just don't understand. Anyway.
It is sad, and they just make this reality crap. They've got a show about tow trucks. Okay, I mean, God, there's the game show where the people try to guess the time that Bubba's going to get, you know, drag racing his Chevy Nova. You know, it's like, are you kidding? This is Jeopardy for quarter mile times. And then they have the show about tow trucks, and
at 10 p.m. they're going to show finally the MotoGP race.
Yeah, yeah, and I've given up. I used to be able to always turn that show on, that channel on, and there'd be something worth watching. It might be fucking boats or lawnmowers or airplanes or whatever, but there'd be something worth watching. Now, meh, I turn it on for Formula One and MotoGP, and that's it.
Yeah.
All right. So,
all right. Well, anyway, great 250 race.
Awesome.
I mean, it was
the last one, Brno, was great too. I mean, if you
Brno
haven't,
was a great race also, yeah. But Brno was a lot cleaner.
yes. If you haven't been watching the 250s, you've got to start. Misano was like I said, if you're gonna, the one race where you're gonna show your non motorcycle racing fan friend, you know, here you got to watch this. That's I think Misano was like that.
I think so too. This year, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
But all right, we've kind of gone on and on and on. So, well, I don't know. You kind of got anything else, or?
I don't think so.
No, neither do I. So I think, why don't we go ahead and call it a night and or a day or whatever when you're listening to this podcast. And next week, you and I are on our way to Indy.
Yep. We're going to do a show.
We're going to have to figure something out somehow. It'll have to be a day early because I'm flying.
We'll do a short show.
Something.
It'll be fun.
So, right on. All right, we will we'll see you next week, and we will have a sort of an indie pre-race for our next week's MotoGP, and the following show, which will be September 19th. It'll be in February, but September 19th, we'll have our indie wrap-up. So it's going to be good stuff. Can't wait.
We're going to see those 250 races in person.
Yes, I know. I've never – yeah, exactly. Well, I saw them at Donington. But basically, we got there after the 250 race had already started. Ooh, so, it's going to be great. All right. Well, we'll talk to you later, Jules. Thanks a lot.
Okay, ciao.
All right. That's going to do it for today's show. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for downloading it. I thought it was a good call with Jules. When I was editing it all together, I was kind of listening to it again and enjoyed it. I thought that was a good conversation. If you're going to be an indie next week, I hope I see you because I will be there. Jules will be there. Jim Reese will be there. There's going to be, lots of people there. It's going to be a big race. Looking forward to that. Not so much because I think, that Indianapolis is going to be all that wonderful of a track. Quite frankly, I think the track will be a bit of a dud because it's a roval in effect, dead flat and all that. But I think that the folks at Indianapolis are going to put on a good show. And this is what it is, folks. We've already discussed this. The whole thing is a show in one way or the other. So I'm looking forward to seeing, Indianapolis, the home of American motorsport and all that good stuff, and seeing just the sort of whole effect. We're going to be out there, going to meet up with Gordon from Pole Position Travel. That'll be nice to see him again. Going to see a lot of other people. Of course, we'll see Liam Schubert, our guy that's on the Alice team, working as their parts manager. He'll be there, and I'm sure we'll get to stop by and say hi, maybe get a few comments. So in any case, it's going to be great stuff. I'll be wearing a MotoGPOD t-shirt most of the weekend. Jules is probably also going to be occasionally doing that, or if all else fails, I don't know. We'll hook up one way or the other, everybody. So if you're out there at Indy, I hope to be able to say hi to you. And it's going to be good stuff. Let's see. I think that about covers it. Like I said, we are having some website issues this week. So I'm getting those sorted out here. It's been a bit of a disaster. It's been a couple of days now here that the site is down. But I've been trying to fix it, and it just ain't fixing. And not getting a lot of help from my hosting company. And unfortunately, Simon Roberts, my web developer, programmer guy, is apparently on vacation or something because I haven't been able to get a hold of him either. But I'm not sure where the problem lies, to be honest with you. So let's see. I think that about covers it. I do want to plant one little seed. And this just struck me a few minutes ago as I was enjoying a tasty beverage. I don't want a whole bunch of email about this. I'm not trying to generate a conversation with myself. I'm trying to make you guys think and out there and everything. And if you go ahead and send me an email and all of that. It's just I may not be able to reply to them all. What do you think that it's a conspiracy theory here, big time conspiracy theory, that Dorna told Stoner to crash because Rossi had to win at Misano. Just, I mean, I know it's a stupid idea and I don't believe it, but just for a second, think about it. And whatever, we will talk again next week. MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.